Welcome to the River Mountain Church Preaching Library. It is our prayer and indeed our hope that this message might inspire your life. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the preaching of God's Word.
Last time I spoke, I think it was back in March or so, I handled the topic of creation versus evolution. And it was something that is important to me. I went through the public school system, Penn State University, got bombarded with evolution. And really it was a topic that I was planning on continuing with today. But my good friend George Jensen presented me with a book not too long ago, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, fourth edition. The first three editions were done by Josh McDowell, and the fourth edition he's been joined with his son, who's a PhD, Sean McDowell. So this book was originally written in 1972. It was revised three times by Josh, and then in 2017, Sean, his son, came alongside him, and they revised it for a fourth time. George handed me the book, and I was hoping it had a lot of pictures in it, because it's really thick, and it's heavy. And I don't know whether they use lead ink or on this or what the issue is, but I've been able to extract what I want to share today out of the introduction to this book. So George and I are probably competing with each other. How far have you gotten? How far have you gotten? I'm like a tenth of the way into the book. And if you're looking for a book with a lot of meat in it, and a book that requires you to be fully focused when you're reading it, I would highly recommend this book. I'm anxious to see what else has to be said in here. But anyhow, it puts us on a path for today's presentation, Christian Apologetics. And I'm not sure about the rest of you, but you know, the word apologetics is a word that I'd heard, I guess, casually. And every time I heard it, I always kind of had a negative first reaction to it. I don't feel like I need to apologize for my faith. But yet, the more I've gotten into it, the more I've realized that that's really not what apologetics means. Are we sorry for our beliefs? No. Apologetics really means defense of what you believe to be true, defense of. And as Christians, according to 1 Peter 3:15, we should always be ready to defend our faith or defend what we believe. Let me read that. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. Always be ready to give an answer to every man who asks for a reason for the hope that is in you, with gentleness and fear. And as I read in the NIV, it says, with gentleness and respect. Four reasons why Christian apologetics is important today. We are all apologists anyway. I mean, you think about it. My sister had visited with us for several weeks. Many of you got a chance to meet her. I appreciated that. I appreciated the kindness that everyone extended to her. She has ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And the terrible thing about that disease is it's not like you can set your home up and say, well, I'm always, you know, I can do this, but I can't do that. And you set your home up to accommodate you. This is the disease that is progressive. It slowly takes away your muscle control and your body functions. And yet she's handling it well. And she is a Christian. Both Kathy and I are convinced of that. The unfortunate nature is that she lives in Southern Virginia. She does not attend a good local church, and she's asking a lot of questions, which as a Christian apologist, you need to be ready to answer. And under this topic of we are all apologists anyway, I was taking her back down Interstate 81, back down to Winchester, Virginia, to meet her husband who was coming up. And I got a lot of questions while we were traveling. And one of the things that came up was, well, she reads the Bible and she says, well, I'm not sure I really believe that God created the heavens and the earth in 7 days. 7 days, you know, I think it's like a long period of time kind of thing. And I'm like, I'm ready for this question. Because I had just gone over the, you know, the evolution versus creation thing. And I said to her, I said, Lynn, I said, it was 7 literal days, 7 24-hour periods. You can't use the word day for the first time unless you're using it literally. You can't figuratively use the word day when you're using the word day for the first time. Now, I didn't explain that very well, but what I said to her, I said, God has created a 7-day cycle for us. We're supposed to get all of our work done in 6, and we rest on the 7th. Nowhere in the Bible does it say, get all your work done in 6 long periods of time and rest for a long period of time. And she's kind of like, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it makes you feel good when you can defend what you believe to be true. And again, that's the root and core of apologetics. But you want to do things in a manner that are humble and not angry. You don't want to defend your faith with anger. You want to have humility. You want to have gentleness, and it'll be received better. Number 2, apologetics strengthens believers. Think about it. If you have to articulate your beliefs, you gain confidence. Correct? And if you're in the Word and you're ready and you've got a little bit of a track record of articulating, you know, by talking with people that are kind of a friendly face, you gain confidence in your faith. Number 3, it helps students hang on to their faith. I read a sad thing. It says 1/3 to 2/3 of Christian students who go on to secondary education step away from the church. Primarily because they're at their time of their lives where they have a lot of questions about their faith. They're being challenged from professors and from others of maybe different religions, and their faith is not as deep as it needs to be. And because they can't provide the answers, they get frustrated and they fall away. Or they have answers, or they have questions, and there's no one there to provide answers to them, and they fall away. That's you know, sad to hear. Number 4, apologetics helps with evangelism. Facing what missionaries have faced for a long time, how to communicate the gospel to Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, etc. A seed thrown here, a light shown there, may be all person needs to move one step closer to committing themselves to Christ. Ten misconceptions of the Christian faith. You can go to the next slide, Cody. You know, every one of these, all 10 of these, is a sermon unto itself. So I'm going to provide the 10 misconceptions to you, and I'm going to provide maybe a little bit more detail to it, and I'm going to try very, very hard not to go off on a tangent and start a separate sermon on one of these 10s. But you could go back, and I may, and do a sermon on any one of these 10. It's just, but these are things Again, this is with what Sean and Josh McDowell have found over the years, that these are the 10 most prevalent misconceptions of people that are non-Christians as to why they don't want to become a Christian. They put up a wall, and this is the reasons. Number one, faith is blind. Christianity doesn't need evidence. It's blind, irrational, and stupid. Or they think Christians are blind, irrational, and stupid. Simple answer is not blind faith, but biblical faith, intelligent faith, trusting faith, not a leap into the dark, but a step into the light. Number two, and it's good. See, I'm moving right along here. Number two, how can Christianity be true because the church has committed injustices? That's all true. It's hard to refute something like that. But if you're ready for that type of a question, I've provided some of the things that will help answer it. But first of all, let me mention the things that I've listed here. The injustices, the Inquisition, witch hunts, crusades, modern-day sexual abuse. But think of all the positive things the church has done. Because of Christianity, we have hospitals, universities, literacy and education for the masses, separation of political powers, civil liberties, abolition of slavery, modern science, the elevation of women, benevolence and charity, high regard for human life. So again, if you're into being a Christian apologist, be ready to defend your faith with things like this. Someone comes at you and says, "Well, what about the Inquisition?" And then you say, "Well, what about universities? You know, what about all the good things that we've gotten due to Christianity?" Number three, the hypocrisy of Christians undermines the reasonability of the Christian faith. People duck the challenge of the gospel. We are all called to be witnesses. Christians are called to be God's witnesses to the world, to provide an honest and factual account of what we ourselves have experienced. I once was lost, but now I'm blind. Or I'm sorry. I once was blind, but now I see. Sorry. Faith in action. You know, there are a lot of people claiming to be Christians, but there's no action. I'm going to use my wife as an example, and I did get her approval beforehand. Again, when my sister was visiting, you know, Kathy was able to do a lot of things for my sister that, you know, Kathy puts on a bathing suit and helps my sister take a shower, you know, helps trim her toenails. Small things. One day, Lynn came out and she was having a little bit of vertigo and her neck was bothering her. You know, the simple thing as a Christian is, "Oh, we'll pray for you." Not Kathy. She goes and gets the cream, puts it on her neck, and starts massaging her neck. You know, faith in action. And again, while we were traveling south, my sister said to me, and I have to paraphrase here, probably should have wrote it down, but my sister said to me, "You know, if more Christians were like your wife, more people would want to be Christians." You know, that says it all right there. You know, let's do more than just present ourselves as Christians. That's great. But let's, you know, certainly pray for people when the moment is right. But let's do more. Let's be proactive. What else can we do? All right. Number four. Christians are intolerant, and therefore, this is a good reason to reject the Christian faith. Judgmental, arrogant, holier than thou. How many of us can say guilty as charged? We should choose to be humble and gentle. Take a deep breath, gather your thoughts, and then speak. again, when you're presented with a situation where you're talking to a non-Christian, they've challenged you, you know, we all want to fight back, but, you know, take a deep breath, gather your thoughts, speak gently. There can't be just one right religion. Jesus cannot be the only way. I mean, how many times have you heard that? You know, I'm sure Pastor Tom has. It can't just be one right religion. Who are you to say that this? Hey, Jesus said it, not me. You know, take it up with him, right? There was one verse here that I want to read that I know we've all heard before, and I didn't think about it early enough to get it onto a slide. John 14, oops, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, John 14, 6. I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes to the Father except through me. So, like I said, Jesus said it. Take it up with him. Number 6, Christianity and science are at war. And I read that, and I was like, I don't quite understand that. I said, Christianity opposed to science? I said, where did that come from? And apparently there was an individual, I don't have his name here, who was followed by a lot of people who created more or less a man-made myth that Christianity was anti-science. But again, if you know anything about science, you know, you think of Isaac Newton, Blaise Pascal, Francis Bacon, Max Planck, many others that were all theists. They all believed in a God. And they believed in the existence and creativity of God. Number 7, God has not provided enough evidence for rational belief. And I just put what? Question mark. God has not provided enough evidence? And in the book, they use some interesting phraseology. You know, they say you would think that God would have put his stamp on the moon, you know, made by God. Or you would think as you're looking through a microscope and you're looking at a single human cell, it would say, God was here, or something like that. We shouldn't need that type of proof. Just walk out this door and look at God's creation. You know, if you had a chance to participate in the Bible studies, the Truth Project, and all the things there, whether you think of the order of the universe or you think of the order within the single cell of a living being, it's just incredible. Just incredible. The order and the details of just the DNA, you know, the amount of information that is embedded in a single strand of DNA is not by chance. We are not something that climbed out of a swamp billions of years ago. I don't care what you say. If you put a monkey in front of a piano, he's not going to learn how to play, you know, Beethoven. And the evolutionists say, given enough time, a monkey can learn how to play. And I seriously disagree. Seriously disagree. You know, we are all descendants of Adam and Eve. And all the things in our society that have come about by evolution and Darwinism, and it has made everybody second guess this book, which is tragic. And it's our job to be educated and push back intelligently, creatively, humbly, defend your faith. Yeah, God has not provided enough evidence. Okay, number 8. I'm doing pretty good here. Where's Bruce? Doing okay, Bruce? Being a good person is enough to get to heaven. Ooh, have we heard that before? God doesn't send good people to hell. There is no such thing as a good person. Ooh, there's a tough topic there. We are God's most valuable creation, yet we've rebelled against our Creator. Here's the Bible verse I forgot to write down. Mark 7:20-23, and it's in red light lettering, so we know this is Jesus speaking. And he said, "What comes out of a man is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adultery, fornication, murder, theft, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man." Now, that one word, licentiousness, not a word that I've seen very often, so I looked it up. And it says, lacking legal and moral restraints, disregard for strict rules of correctness. Wow, we're seeing a lot of that lately. Number 9, a good God would prevent evil and suffering. God did not merely send an angel, a prophet, or a book. He sent his only son, and at the cross, evil and sin were conquered. You know, God's given us free will, and it's that free will that gets us in trouble. But would you want it any other way? Would God want it any other way? I can't remember the movie, but the one comedian, he gets to be God. Oh, Bruce Almighty. He gets to be God for a little while. And, of course, he has a girlfriend, and she gets mad at him. And he actually sits there, and he says, "Love me, love me." He can do anything in the world, but he can't force her to love him. And that's free will. And it's that free will that gets mankind into trouble. And that's where evil and suffering come about. Does God allow some of it to happen? Yes. But sometimes for the good. There's all sorts of stories in the Bible about people going through suffering, and yet it was for the good. Biblical teaching on sex is regressive and hateful. Now, I've got to admit, this is a topic that, speaking from the pulpit, is difficult. I don't know, Pastor, whether speaking about sex is easy for you from the pulpit, but it's number 10, so I'm talking about it. God designed sex for four reasons. Procreation, unity, recreation, and to glorify God. Sex as God designed it is a wonderful thing. What would the world be like if everyone followed the biblical plan for sex, engaging in sexual activity in a committed, lifelong relationship with someone of the opposite sex? More intact marriages? Less broken homes? More involved fathers? Less sexually transmitted diseases, less teen pregnancies, less abortions. I think God has a pretty good plan when it comes to this topic.
Thanks for listening to this message from River Mountain Church. If you'd like some more information, visit our website, rivermountainchurch.org.